to learn more downstairs. And now we are excited that you're here to join us for the session on Breaking Through, How to Overcome Fears, Inertia, Gender Bias, and Other Obstacles. I'm excited to introduce the thought leader that's going to be hosting us today, Vanessa Loader. Vanessa Loader is an entrepreneur and former private equity investor and the co-founder of Mindfulness-Based Achievement, the new MBA, a company that provides in-person and online educational tools to help high-potential women leaders learn how to lean in without burning out. She's the founder and CEO of Akoya Power, a company that supports women in leading more purposeful professional lives. Through meditation, visualization, and coaching, Loader and her co-founder, Lisa Abramson, teach women how to quiet their minds, set boundaries without feeling guilty, let go of the pressure to be perfect, and get more of what they want in life. Loader's TEDx talk is titled How to Lean In Without Burning Out. Her personal transformation, subsequent research, and work has led to thousands of women finding more passion, success, and love with greater ease. Loader earned an MBA from Stanford University and a BA in Economics from Columbia University, where she graduated Phi Beta Kappa summa cum laude. Please join me in welcoming Vanessa Loader.
Thank you. It is such an honor and a pleasure to be here facilitating this panel. And I am just so excited because I love empowering women. It is literally my life's work and my calling, if you will. And so to be at a conference like this that's for women, looking at an audience of all powerful women, it fills my heart with joy. And I can honestly say that I wake up every single day excited to go to work. And I love my job. I love being an entrepreneur, having a flexible schedule, and doing work that I really believe in. But it wasn't always this way. I spent almost 10 years working in finance, and I've been an overachiever my entire life. You heard a little bit about my resume there. You know, graduated top of my class from an Ivy League school, got my MBA from Stanford. And when I graduated from undergrad, I took the most intense job I could find, which at the time was investment banking on Wall Street. And I would work literally around the clock. I remember this one night when I snuck out to the gym at 9 p.m. 9 p.m., snuck out to the gym because I was waiting for a document to be edited. And I came back to my desk to find an angry post-it note from one of the managing directors saying, "This is unacceptable, where have you been?" And I remember, like, in my gut, in that moment, thinking, there is something wrong with this situation. There is something fundamentally wrong with this. But I want to be successful, so I guess I'll keep doing it. I'll keep forging ahead and, you know, pushing myself. And so that's what I did for many, many years. And after Stanford, I went back to work in private equity as an investor. And I basically got to this point in my career where I was, you know, sitting on the boards of companies, financially very successful, on track to be a partner at my firm. Everything on paper looked great. But inside, I was really lost and deeply unfulfilled and overwhelmed and exhausted. And I felt like I had sort of climbed to the top of this ladder only to look around and go, like, crap, wrong ladder. So I had a bit of a breakdown, which Brené Brown is speaking later today, who I'm obsessed with. Please go see her talk. She would call a spiritual awakening. And I basically went back to my mind and research around how can I get myself out of this mess. So I started looking at all the research around mindfulness and meditation and ways to reduce my stress and anxiety, and I became fascinated by it. And as I studied more and more, I learned about neuroplasticity and how we can literally rewire our brains to be more oriented towards happiness and joy and gratitude rather than fear and stress and anxiety. And I learned ways to reprogram my neurology to change my response to stressful situations. So I ended up, it was like my overachiever pretty much just went nuts in the personal development space for many years. My husband was like, "Are you just going to be a workshop junkie? Like, this is not going to work out." And I ended up transforming myself so dramatically that I quit my job and decided that what I wanted to do was spend my life bringing these tools that had changed me so much to other people, and especially to women in the business world who are ambitious and have big dreams and visions and want to do something with their lives. And they want to be successful, but they want to define success on their own terms that's more aligned with their values and their real authentic selves. And they want to, you know, strive for their goals in a way that's more sustainable. So that's what I do now, and I run these corporate programs and online classes for women. And I'd love to support all of you, so if you want to learn more, come find me at the end of this panel, and I can give you more information. So that's a little bit about me, and now let's get started with these incredible women on our panel. So I would love to just start by having each of you spend a couple of minutes saying who you are and your background, and I prepped them for this, but something we do in our classes that I find really helpful is we start with one thing that you're grateful for. So I'd love for you to start with one thing you're grateful for and then share a little bit about your background. So we'll start with you, Jill, and just kind of go down the line.
Okay. I'm Jill Abramson. I have been a journalist for all of my career. I was the first woman to be Washington bureau chief of the Times, the first woman to be managing editor of the New York Times, and then I was named to the top job of executive editor in 2011 and got fired from that job noisily, as most of you know, last spring. I teach a writing class at Harvard, undergraduates in the English department. Now I'm involved in a journalism startup that will be a digital news product that I'm very excited about. And, you know, I am grateful always for the support of my family. I think that probably the quality, now that I have turned 60 and feel like I have a fair amount of past and hindsight, I thought Diane von Furstenberg this morning was so eloquent on that. But, you know, having your family standing with you over the years reinforces a quality that I think women have in spades, and that is resilience. And every one of you is going to face a setback either in your personal life or in your professional life. You would be surprised, since I was fired and was very open about saying I was fired. I mean, it seems to be the universal experience, not just of women, but of many men, too. But the day after I was fired, my sister called me up on the phone, and she said to me, you know, our father would be just as proud of you today as the day you were named as executive editor of the Times. And just getting that call meant the world to me. And so I am grateful for my kids, for my husband, lifelong friends. My college roommate from Harvard is here with me today. So I'm very grateful for, you know, all the friendships. All of that is what, in the end, sustains all of us.
Thank you.
I'm Jessica Heron. I'm the founder and CEO of Stella & Dot, a social selling company that has a few brands, Stella & Dot, Keep Collective, and Ever Skincare. It's really about giving women a platform for flexible entrepreneurship and modernizing what it's like to run your own business. I almost had your story. I had an apartment and a job in New York, and then I realized that the investment bank that I was going to work for at the time had a policy in which women were not allowed to wear pants and had to wear sun-colored nylons. And I just, that's a deal breaker. I'm not working for someone who thinks they can dictate what I'm wearing. It's not going to happen. So I went on a different path and became which was technology startup, and I've been basically doing that for 2 decades since. From there, I went back to Stanford Business School, where I dropped out to co-found the company that became WeddingChannel.com, and it was a great entrepreneurial experience. And I was very much in that point in my career where I wanted to do something I loved. I pursued entrepreneurship. I was there, I realized I had done it, and still felt soulfully unfulfilled because I didn't think that I was doing something that was my calling. I was doing something commercially successful and what other people would deem a success, but when I got up in the morning, was that how I wanted to spend my one life on the planet? The answer to that was no, so I changed it. I followed my husband to Texas, became a mother, and during nights and weekends really got curious about the question of democratizing entrepreneurship and reinventing, using technology to, and a mission to reinvent what flexibility in the workforce could look like for women. And out of my living room started the mission of what became Stella and I. And now it's a company that has about 30,000 independent entrepreneurs in 6 countries and is truly about a life coaching business. I've gone through the same experience of how to quiet the voices in my head around it's never enough, you know, the feeling guilty or not really having perspective and gratitude, recognizing how that really fuels your daily happiness, not some other yardsticks of success like a title or a paycheck. So that's been my path to my career and to happiness.
Thank you. Darla?
Hi, I'm Darla Anderson. I am a producer at Pixar Animation Studios. I've been there, this is my 23rd year that I've been there, so I started when I was about 18. Shouldn't be that funny. No, just kidding. I went to Pixar because I was really, really excited about wanting to do something on the planet that would change, that would change the world. I believe in art. I believe that art has the power to change our society and impact everything that we do, inspire us to do greater things, shape our society that we live in. And when I was in college, we share Glendale Community College before we transferred on to...
Oh, proud alum.
Yeah, we're proud alum of Glendale Community College in L.A. But when I was going to college, all my friends were in business. And in my mind, I thought, you know, I'm going to be doing business my whole life. I'd like to really understand the arts. I was artist of the family, and I wanted to understand deeply what the arts meant. And I really wanted to change the world, and I truly believe that art can do that. So when I got involved in production and all kinds of film production, because media can do more, have more impact than almost anything, especially these days, I fell in love with computer animation. And so packed up my bags, moved to San Francisco with literally not a nickel to my name, and knocked on the door of Pixar Animation Studios for 2 years until I got in. Did it in a non-stalkery kind of way. You know, I did like every 6 months. And I got a thanks-but-no-thanks letter from actually who's one of our esteemed senior managers now, Deirdre Warren. And I thought, oh, that's a mistake. Like that. Oh, because they kept taking my phone calls. So knocked on the doors. And I really wanted to be a part of this pioneering effort, this first ever all-computer animated feature film called Toy Story. So anyway, I knocked on the doors till I got in. They finally did hire me in, and then the rest is kind of history. I've been working there for the last 22 years. I love my job. I had the enormous great fortune of working directly with Steve Jobs for over 5 years. He worked at the company full time back then because he owned us, and it's been a wild ride. And that's my general professional story.
Awesome. Thank you. Oh, and I realized the gratitude. I think we forgot.
Did you say gratitude?
Yeah.
Oh, yes. Okay. My gratitude is always I feel guilty because I feel like it should be a broader perspective, like being an American. But whenever I meditate on gratitude, I instantly envision my 8-year-old's face and the little freckles on her nose and her green eyes, and just she's pure love. And so then I quickly move on to my other daughter and husband. And gratitude, because I do love them deeply. It's just that that's my baby. So I'm grateful for them all.
A guilty gratitude. I've never heard that before. Thank you.
Yeah, I just feel like I am grateful for so many things. I feel like working in the entertainment industry is just such a privilege. And the love of my life. And so I'm just grateful that I have this job and have amazing coworkers, some of whom are here today. Yeah. I have amazing, super powerful female producers, women producers here. They're here today supporting. So awesome. I'm super grateful for this job.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Gina Rahag. I'm the SVP and CIO of Riverbed Technology. I've been there about 18 months, and previously I've had a lot of career in high tech. I didn't start in IT, though. And it's one of those interesting things. I actually went to school at night, put myself through school at night with my family, didn't have a lot of financial resources, and met a lot of great people in doing that, made some phenomenal industry connections, went in to do a business, finance, accounting type of role, went through the semiconductor industry in the 90s here in the Valley, saw a lot of change, a lot of disruption, a lot of mergers and acquisitions, and then actually went into my first full IT job about halfway through my career. And it's funny how parallels. You don't really understand the seeds that are really planted by your parents early on. My mom and dad, my mom was a single mom. She raised me here in the city. And I would go to work with her. She was a key punch operator and a tape librarian for mainframes. So I would play on the key punch machine, and she would be checking and logging things, and she worked nights and weekends and worked a whole bunch just to make sure that I had a good life. And then she met my dad there, and he was a COBOL programmer. So when I was growing up, we had the first modem, we had the first Apple, we had the first of everything, and I was like, I don't want anything to do with technology. And now I'm a technology junkie. So I've been very fortunate. My parents have been a blessing in my life, and particularly I'm most grateful for my father, who passed in 2011. Mm-hmm. And he really, even though he was my stepfather, he adopted me when I was 12, and he was really the only dad I knew. And I wanted to be a marine biologist. I told him when I was growing up, I'm going to buy a house in Hawaii, because he was Hawaiian. And so I'm going to buy you a house in Hawaii. I'm going to be this marine biologist. And he said, you can do anything you want to do. When I said I wanted to be an airline attendant so we could get free airfare and discount, the one thing he said when I was 12, why be the airline attendant when you can actually be the pilot? So I'm most grateful for that, and I'm also equally grateful for my husband, because he supports my career, he supports everything that I do, and I wouldn't be here, I wouldn't have this opportunity, I wouldn't be in front of you sharing my story if I didn't have that support system there. So two men that are very meaningful in my life.
See, it takes a village. You need men, too.
It does.
Great. Well, thank you so much for sharing a little bit about your backgrounds. Yeah. And then this panel is all about overcoming obstacles, fear, and inertia, and the things that can keep women stuck. So I would love to hear from each of you, what was a really big obstacle that you faced in your career? And it could be an internal obstacle, you know, fear, confidence, what have you, or an external obstacle, like something, some wall you just couldn't seem to get through externally. Maybe we'll start with you this time, Jessica.
Well, I think the biggest obstacles, the only real obstacles, are internal. I think we all battle, whether it's guilt over being a working mom or your own fears and insecurities around, am I good enough to do this? Do I have what it takes to do this? And I've come to realize that any internal obstacle I faced has been actually the greatest gift, because it made the other one seem like nothing. So I think if I really were to boil it down, it was probably just when I was growing up. My parents went through a very messy divorce, and my mom left, and I haven't spoken to her, you know, mostly since. And I think that I really struggled with that feeling of, you know, abandonment early in my life, and that would happen when I was a young teen. But the beautiful thing about that, honestly, is that you face this very base fear that seems to come alive in every Disney or Pixar film, where, you know, Nemo's mom gets eaten, and then there you are. And, you know, or you think that it's something that you're entitled to, or that everybody else seems to have, you don't have, and you feel like there's something wrong with me. But then that happens, and then there you are, you're still standing. So you realize that you are that resilience very early on, that's not gonna kill you. You can still find happiness, you can still go on. So the other obstacles I had around what data we couldn't afford for me to go straight to a university, and the odds were against me, I mean, incredibly, to go from Glendale Community College to transfer to Stanford, but I figured, why not? And then there I went. And ever since, I've never really focused on the odds or the unlikelihood of success as an entrepreneur. Because if you were to look at that, you'd be very daunted. And you might be so daunted that you never tried. And I've always said, well, it's going to be somebody. Why not me? I've survived worse. I can do this. So I think my internal obstacles have always been the greatest, and ones that are the most worthy of overcoming.
Thank you. And what do you attribute that mindset to be able to say, like, well, why not? Maybe I could go to Stanford, because I think there's a lot of people who are in that situation
might have a story around, oh, I'll never get in, why bother trying, blah, blah, blah. So what, you know, what do you think enabled you to ask that question? Like, why not me?
Perspective. I often think that I come from royalty. I feel so proud of my family. My father's mother came to this country with a fourth grade education and, you know, quickly became a widow and had a 1 year and 3 year old where she could, you know, barely speak English, and she worked nights and weekends, and she actually had a job stuffing the jelly into donuts, if you're wondering how it got there. It used to be that my grandma put it there. And she took in laundry. She did whatever she could to just survive and take care of her family. And so I just think about whatever I was facing, just the perspective of, she found a way to be happy and thrive with all that challenge. And I really have always felt that it's your perspective of gratitude and your relative positioning of the world. And the other most germane moment in my life was with an incentive trip that I went on in Morocco with our European stylists. And there was, at that time, outbreak in Libya. And we were wondering, why are they rioting in the streets in Libya and not here? Why is the people, like, you know, the king of Morocco? And they're like, well, that's because, you know, 14 years ago, he's such a progressive, he's such a good king, he let girls go to school. And I just said that, like, 14 years ago? You mean if I were born here, it would have been illegal for me to learn to read and write? So just the constant reminder of, frankly, you're kind of lucky. No matter what you got going on, you can always find a perspective that in some facet of my life, I'm lucky and I can focus on that. And then you just sort of realize that the rest of it doesn't really matter much, and you can be confident and fearless. Because even if you fail, you know, you've still got something else to be grateful for.
Right. That makes sense. Yeah, there's that saying, you know, if we all threw our problems in a jar and then we saw everyone else's, we'd probably go, oh, that was back really fast. Yeah, great. And Dalia, I'd love to hear, you know, some of the biggest obstacles that you've faced, either internal or external.
Yeah, we had similar echoes of our stories. When I was a kid in Glendale, California, I'm very proud of that town, I don't know. My mom died when I was 13 in a car accident, and through a series of events, I ended up on my own and homeless when I was probably 13 and a half, 14 years old. And so that, you know, obviously quite daunting. I ended up, you know, Glendale is not downtown LA. So when you're homeless in Glendale, you're likely to be lucky enough to be sleeping on friends' couches, which I did, and become au pair to, ironically, a Disney attorney at the time. By whose bylaws we all live now, which is, yeah. I have lots of little random coinkydinks in my life. But I always had a feeling that I was born under a lucky star, so much so that I have one tattooed on the back of my neck. And I think that attitude, that I always felt lucky, transcends, and then you make luck. And I did have a lot of confidence. I did have the feeling that I had lost everything, and so I had nothing to lose. But I will say this, too. I mean, I was scared all of the time, too. I tell my story, and sometimes it sounds like, wow, that girl was superhuman that she made it through all this stuff. But I think it's the definition of courage that you feel the fear but walk through it anyway, I think. And so I always want to emphasize that I spent the vast majority of my time being in a fearful state but walking through it anyway. Under the guise that I had nothing to lose. I had lost everything. So that was that obstacle. And then, you know, I decided I made it through college, and then I transferred. I don't know why I didn't think Stanford, but I thought San Diego State.
Sunny, warm.
I love the beach, it's true. You know, what actually happened is a friend was going down there. I actually didn't think I had the confidence to move on from Glendale Community College, even though I was Woman of the Year, my $500 scholarship, and Director of Fine Arts. I actually didn't have the confidence to move past junior college, but a friend was going to San Diego State, so I just jumped on that bandwagon and filed too. I'm like, okay, yeah, me too. I'll be your roommate. And then got a degree in environmental design and art, and I always gravitated towards the 3D and the sculpture of it all. And then I just, again, like I told you guys earlier, I didn't want to make money to make money. Had a lot of great jobs, though. I ended up landed in good jobs, but I didn't want to get settled in a corporate career without following my true calling, which I always felt was some kind of art, some mm-hmm. kind of impact on the world via art or city planning or something of that ilk. So I always quit the job. job before I got too comfortable. Right about when I was just going to make about $70,000, which is a lot of money in the 80s, I would quit and try to find the next thing. So when I figured out Pixar, I just quit my jobs and got in my car. And the other obstacle I overcome is coming out of the closet. Now, this is pre-Ellen, pre-Melissa, pre-a lot of things. Like, Ellen didn't come out of the closet well into my career at Pixar. I mean, I wasn't even out of the closet when I started at Pixar. So I think that was a lot of those barriers were, took a lot of courage to keep having the tenacity to go through. And quite often in a lot of my cases, people kind of pushed me through the door. Like, I didn't on purpose come out of the closet at Pixar. There's a guy at work who is hilarious, and we've all been there 20 years, and he decided to start an alias called the Pixmos. He put me on it. There was like 10 of us at work. And because he had seen me walking around the Castro. And,
busted.
But, you know, she's a femme dyke. And all of the systems guys came right into my office, and they're like, were two at the time. They're like, Kevin wants you to be on the this Pixmos alias. I go, great. You know? So I said, yeah. They go, do you know what that is? Do you know what that means? I go, I'm putting it together. Yeah, I get it. So it's not like I've been like this rah-rah, like super out there person that, I broke through all these magical barriers. But when presented with the opportunity to stay in the closet or not, I did accept, tell the truth. So that was another, that was a huge thing at the time, which, you know, under the heading of lots of positive stuff, I cannot believe that I'm sitting here at this conference with these amazing women saying that I'm a lesbian working as a leader at a major corporation. I didn't really ever think I'd see that in my lifetime. And I'm just so feel grateful for that. And that while we still have so far to go, we have really come a long way in a much shorter period of time than I thought we would in so many issues.
I think the interesting question about it is, and maybe we'll just take a poll in the audience, earlier in the session in the morning they talked about a lot of our courage comes from adversity. So how many of you in the room have gone through some kind of adversity in your life?
Everybody.
Right? Exactly, right? And I think it's what you do with that and how you actually turn that. A lot of it is about the people that are surrounding you, and some of that comes down to the people you choose to surround you. The people you choose to surround and be associated with to support. And you have to look for those equal support systems. And they come in all kinds of fashions, in all kinds of different situations, and you just have to be open enough to embrace them. And I think when you start dropping some of the judgments or some of the societal labels, and I think, you know, Darla's story speaks to that, you start to actually experience life very differently. And you become more open. And a lot of that is a lot of the obstacles that I've had to try and overcome is overachiever, being perfect, the oldest. I have two young sisters that are 12 and 15 years younger than me, having to... You know, I actually babysat my 12-year-old. I was 12 years old. I babysat a 6-month-old for this whole summer to help the family. And my mom and dad worked in the city, and we lived in Petaluma. So they left at 5 in the morning and didn't get home until about 6 at night. That's a lot of responsibility for a 12-year-old. And I apologize to my sister all the time because I was not very nice that 6-month-old. But, you know, she's like, so you own me for the rest of your life, right? But, you know, it's those adversities and those times and how you surround yourself with family and how you take those opportunities. But it is really about getting comfortable with who you are, what is good enough for you, and only you can identify that. Every time we try and live up to all of these other labels, barriers, stigmas, I'm really big about stigmas. My husband stays at home. He had a very successful construction company. When my career took off, we had to sit down and have a very honest conversation. Are we going to have both? Or are we actually going to pick which one? And I told him, I said, I'm totally fine walking away and supporting your company. And he goes, you have a better run than I do. And so we shut his company down in 2011. And he had a really good company. He made it through the 08 crash, through everything. We kept all of our employees on board. But, you know, that right there, just being able to have that conversation and understand the relationship that my husband and I have, that he's confident enough, but let me tell you the stigmas he gets and the stigmas I get, because he is the primary drop-off and pick-up at the school for my son. So, you know, you got to kind of just check those at the door. I like what you said, Jessica. I really identify with, you know, you got to understand what's around you, but don't let it define you. And you do have to kind of ignore some of that stuff and just move on. So to me, that's a lot of what obstacles really are every day, is what are you going to do with that opportunity and how are you going to translate it for yourself?
Great. Thank you so much. That reminds me, in our MBA program, we have this equation, because we're former finance geeks, E plus R equals O, which is the events in our life plus our reaction to them is what creates the outcomes that we have. So it's really how you respond or how you react to these adverse situations that actually determines the outcome you're going to have. Mm-hmm. So it's so wonderful to hear you all articulate this. And Jill, I'd love to hear from you, some of the obstacles you faced.
Well, you know, I have not dwelled that much on the obstacles, and I think it tracks back in a way to when I was very little. I remember my grandmother looking at me and just shaking her. Truer words were never spoken. She looked at me and she said, "Baby, you are just so hard-headed." Mm-hmm. And, you know, I have a real kind of ornery streak. And, you know, a barrier to me is, I see it as kind of a delicious challenge, usually. And, you know, listening to these other, you know, fabulous panelists give such great answers, I just, you know, drifted back to the fact that, you know, it was, you know, an incredible honor in my family that I got into Harvard. That's where I went to college. And my father, who hadn't gone to college, was so excited about that. It was my freshman year, as 1972, was the first year that women were allowed to live in Harvard Yard.
Wow.
And my hand flew up. I was like going to be one of the first women to live in Harvard Yard. And, you know, to say that not all the men were thrilled to have us living in Harvard Yard would be an understatement. But, it was kind of a wonderful time in many ways. And, you know, when I'm going to class, sometimes now I walk through, I guess, 20 years after that. So that was 72 and 92. Harvard actually dedicated a gate in Harvard Yard to the women who were in my class, the pioneers. And, you know, I discovered journalism during my college years, and I remember getting an assignment to, it was thrilling, to go cover the New Hampshire primary in 1976. I was then not only finishing Harvard, but as what's called a stringer, a part-time college campus reporter for Time magazine, and I was covering some of the, you know, lesser candidates in the Democratic field in New Hampshire. I remember going to the Sheraton Wayfarer bar and looking like at the bar, and there were like the giants of the political journalism world, you know, David Broder of the Washington Post and Johnny Apple, and, you know, these are names that some of you are too young to remember, but, I mean, Hunter Thompson, the gonzo journalist, was there too, but it was all men at the bar, and I remember thinking, like, I will just never break into, you know, this fraternity, not a chance. But why I had the assignment to do the reporting that night was because Time Magazine's Boston Bureau at that point was actually headed by a woman named Sandy Burton, who was the first woman to become a bureau chief at Time. And it turned out, as I got to know her better, she had started out as a secretary at Time, and she had literally clawed her way into the reporting ranks. And she took a special interest in this young kid, me, who really didn't have much experience at all, but had a, she could see a passion for journalism and a willingness to learn. And, you know, she made sure that I got some really good experience early on. And isn't it Madeleine Albright? I'm sitting here thinking, do I have this right? I think it is that Madeleine Albright said there's a special place in hell reserved for women who don't help other women. It's absolutely true. And when I became, I stayed in touch. I wrote letters with Sandy through the years. And when I was named Washington Bureau Chief, I was the first woman to get that job, I got a telegram. Remember the day of the old-fashioned telegram? So a telegram arrived, and Sandy was then based in Hong Kong, and it was a telegram from her that just said, I can hear the glass shattering all the way to Hong Kong. Which meant the world to me. So I do think whatever, you know, hardships and barriers and tough times like all of us face and women in the workforce face now, that, you know, having a woman at a more senior place than you are looking out for you and trying to make it a little bit better can really make a difference.
Thank you. And I'd love to hear from each of you, you know, some more practical advice you would have and kind of actionable things that women in this audience can do if they're, I was just talking to a woman in our program the other day who is incredibly successful, Bain consultant, Wharton MBA, and she's like, I really want to start like a lifestyle business, a healthcare business, but I'm too scared. And I took a safe job and I quit my job, but I kind of compromised with this other intermediary job. What kind of advice would you have to someone like that who has a dream they want to go after, but they just feel like they can't quite do it? So Dara, we'll start with you this time.
I guess I'll just relate to my story, and that is that, I'm always practical and logical, so it depends on so much of the situation. Does she have children? What's going on? There's a lot of really practical, depending on your lifestyle situation, if you have to take care of a family, you have to take that into consideration and really prepare for that and be realistic about that. So I'm just nothing if not logical, realistic about those things. But that aside, I feel like you have to get really in touch with your inner vision and voice. I have to tell you, like when I wanted to come to Pixar, people told me many, many things, none of which were either true or came true. And for example, they said, you can never be a producer. You're just too nice and you're too soft. And there's like, that'll never work out for you anyway. And that was one thing that never came true. They also told me never to move to the Bay Area. The Bay Area, if you want to be a producer, you need to be in Hollywood. You need to be, you cannot move to San Francisco and be successful in any kind of entertainment industry. This is 1990, I guess. Mm-hmm. And I just really didn't agree with that at all. And I just really felt like Toy Story was going to be the future of something, or this industry, this computer animated industry, was going to be the future of something big. I had that conviction inside of me that, and I was really sparking towards it and really excited about it. So if you've got that kind of feeling inside of you that you have, that you have to trust that. And then it took me 2 years to get in the door. So, you know, the practicality, I was younger, I didn't have kids, I didn't have a lot of responsibility, so I think you, realistically, it's easier to make those risks. But if you have that curiosity and spark and voice inside of you, I really wouldn't listen to too much common sense beyond the practical care and feeding of your family, and really commit to and trust that voice inside of you to do what your calling is.
I love that. I just love the courage and the conviction that you had to kind of stay true to that vision. And basically, don't listen to the haters, is what you're saying.
Yeah.
And it kind of touches on, Gina, what you said around, it's really important who you surround yourself with, because those are the voices that are going to be giving you input. And, you know, one small thing I'll share is that my, I love my mother. I love her to death. She secretly wished that she had a career on Wall Street as background. So when I quit that job to do something else, I would call her very excited about new opportunities, and she would just kind of burst my bubble, and she would come at me with the one, well, what did you think about that, and what about this, and you know, she wanted to protect me because she was scared. And it was when I was talking to one of my coaches, I said, yeah, I just had this other, I had this great opportunity, but then my mom said, she said, why do you call your mom every time you're excited? Yeah. All she does is bring you down. And it was this real moment, because I had a loyalty. It's my mother. I love her. And I had to just realize, like, in this particular instance, she's not able to support me in the way that I need. I'm not going to go to her for this. And I found a group of women who could support me in the way that I needed, and I went to them. So I would invite you to let go of, you know, even the, some of those closest bonds, if those people can't meet you in that vision that you have for what you want in your life.
Yeah.
So, Gina, I'd love to hear your nodding.
Yeah, you know, I think some of the things that I've learned is really you have to figure out how you're going to build that confidence and what confidence looks like for you. You do have to surround yourself with people because they're the ones that are going to actually help you when you are questioning yourself, and they're the ones that are going to push you when you're not challenging yourself either. And they're going to say, why are you taking the easy road? And those are trusted relationships that even when you're having the worst day, you can call and go and clear your head and get that reinforcement or validation. Or even, honestly, people you need to surround yourself with that says, yeah, you are crazy. Don't even, you know, that maybe there's a different way to achieve what you're trying to do, right? So for those things are sanity checks. You do have to also take into consideration, I live by the motto, go big or go home. I'm a big water person. I have a boat. I go on a one-week houseboating trip, zero connection with my family in the middle of the lake, and we just wakeboard every day, all day. And we have a goal. We just want to add one trick in the whole week. And we're at an age now where we're like, it takes us 2 days to recover from the first day, so it's just, it's getting, we're like, maybe it's one trick every 2 years now, we're not sure, but, you know, but it's like, how do you set that bar? And it doesn't have to be a huge monumental bar, it just has to be something that you feel that you can accomplish and that you'll feel proud of. And if you can find a group of people that share those kind of common interests and objectives in their own life, then you find that support system that you start to weave together. I do think it's also, you know, you have to, my dad told me growing up, he says, look, and I had some friend issues, what girl doesn't have friend issues in middle school, right? And he said, look, you know, what you're going to learn through the next several years of school and in college, and you'll see this in business, is this is where politics starts to come in. And clicks and this and that. And he goes, you just need to figure out, you're smart enough, Gina, that you can sit back, figure out what strategy they're playing, figure out what game, what the rules of that game are. You're going to beat them every single time. Don't let them beat you down. Don't let people define what you can or can't do. And I've applied that to a lot of business situations, and it's so true. If you just kind of sit back and say, okay, there is a game being played, because there's a lot of games that are always played, I'm just going to figure out how, you know, what is the motive? What's the fear factor here? The threat? I'm tall, so I got ridiculed a lot in school for being tall. Jolly Green Giant, you know, the names go on. Amazon Woman, how many have ever been called that? Yeah, all right. It's like, oh, thanks. Is that a compliment? But, you know, it was someone that I worked with. Halfway through my career, she said, you know, why do you wear flats all the time? You're tall. You can command a room. You should embrace your height. So many people, and, you know, and it's true, whatever you have, if you have curly hair, you want straight hair. If you have straight hair, you want curly hair. If you're short, you're tall. And it is true, and it's just really about another life lesson of figure out what you have, the assets you have, what's good enough for you, what's going to make you happy, and live by that, and go big or go home.
I love that. So own your strengths, go big or go home, and find lots of support to surround yourself with, and then take those small goals and just one step at a time.
Yep.
Right. And Jill, what practical advice would you have?
Well, you know, one of my favorite pieces of advice was actually offered by Anna Quinlan, who I think is a fantastic writer and someone who had a fabulous career at the New York Times before she left to write novels and do her column for Newsweek. And she was giving the commencement speech at Barnard College a couple of years ago. And she opened her speech by saying that in college she had majored in not being afraid. And I thought that was just, you know, a fantastic piece of advice to offer bright young women who are about to go out into the world. But, like, how do you become not afraid is, you know, I think a challenging question. It's definitely, I think, exactly the right way to live your life, to try to major in not being afraid. And I think there are several answers to that question. One is, you know, to have a fierce passion for the work you do and to go about doing it as excellently as you possibly can. To know you are excellent, I think, helps you not be afraid. And then, you know, a few of us have talked about, you know, quieting that voice we all have inside our heads that's always actually, rather than the people calling you the Jolly Green Giant, it's the voice inside your own head telling you you don't measure up in A to Z ways. And how you quiet that voice is, I think, a big challenge for people. And, you know, I do believe in things like doing yoga. And, you know, I have always gone for 2 very long walks with my dog every day. I'm not today, unfortunately. But just as a kind of clearing your mind and, like, stilling that voice. But at the end of the day, I just think, like, a sense of your own authenticity is really important, and that if you're hearing that voice all the time that in a meeting is telling you, well, maybe you're being too pushy, or maybe you're not being forceful enough, that's always like fine-tuning, that it's going to be hard to find that true authenticity. But I think other people in a room can see it and smell it, and if you don't have it, you're not in the end going to be either true to yourself or be successful.
Thank you. I love that. Majoring in fear. Wish I did that. I feel like I majored in perfection and stuff. All right, Jesse, I'd love to hear from you. Practical advice.
I think you guys have really nailed it. The biggest thing I think it starts with is putting your ear down to your heart and listening hard and truly understanding what are your life priorities, what matters to you, and then are you living in accordance with those priorities and values. So many people who are making scary choices, if you are not choosing something that's authentic to your heart, but rather is just buzzword du jour, like, are you honestly interested in the Internet of Things or the sharing economy? Or are you doing that because it was what you last read about in Fast Company? And if you are going to pursue something inauthentically, you will get exhausted fast. You will get daunted fast. If you're not utterly passionate, you don't understand your why. I love when Don Van Furstenberg this morning talked about how women are strong. And if you're a mother, you really believe that if a car were on top of your baby, you would go over there and you would lift up that car. But it has to come from this extreme love, this extreme passion. And if you can find what in the world you have that extreme love for, then you will go pursue that thing like a tiger. You will go get over every obstacle. You will be afraid and travel through the fear anyway. You will have the tenacity to outlast the hurdles and problems that just exist in life. No one who is successful created that success because their business or their life was on a unicorn farm where it was all sunshine and rainbows and there were no problems. They just, it doesn't happen, right? So they just did it because they found something they loved enough to risk being a fool for. I think you should be a fool for love, and that's where I think you create your best life.
I love that. It's such a great thing to end on. And I know we wanted to save a couple of minutes for some audience questions, so we just have a few minutes left. We have some mics at the front. So if anyone has a question for our panel, yes.
Hi, ladies. Sometimes the interpersonal style expectations seem to be different for males versus females. Mm-hmm. While males are applauded for being outspoken and natural leaders, females, most recently, Jill, you were for being considered too brisk, too ambitious. What's the feedback you give to these women on how to react and act on the feedback that we often get in the workplace?
In 2 minutes or less, please.
Well, sir, I mean, I do share your sense and your question that there's definitely a double standard, that qualities that are seen as exhibiting leadership in men are seen as, you know, Sheryl Sandberg has, you know, had a wonderful, I think, riff on the word bossy, and she would like to see it retired, right? But, you know, that women who exhibit similar qualities are seen as too pushy, or I think it wasn't brisk, but brusque, actually, which, you know, I view as I have a direct style, and men are accepted when they are direct, but that is seen somehow as brusque or critical in a woman. I think those are serious societal, cultural issues that over time I very much hope will change. And like how you deal with that double standard, I think, you know, you have to be aware and almost like play defensively against those kinds of stereotypes. But in the end, it, I think, does track back to what I was saying in my last answer, that if you're constantly trying to calibrate what your perfect presentation for maximum acceptability is going to be, you're going to somehow not be authentic, and that isn't the way to deal with it.
I would only add, don't quiet your voice. Keep speaking. Just keep talking.
Great, thank you. We have a question down there.
Are you happy with where your life has taken you?
Oh, that's a good one.
So beautiful.
Ecstatic. Yeah.
So good.
Are you happy where your life has taken you? Was the question. Jessica says ecstatic. I would agree. I mean, I think, you know, sometimes we try to overplan our lives. And at one of my transition times, one of our CTOs came to me and he says, just be open. Don't try and plan everything because you will filter out things on the fringe that could be really powerful or moving for you. So, you know, just be open to everything that's out there.
Great. Thank you. Any question here?
Hi, my name is Bianca St. Louis. First, thank you guys so much for just sharing your stories and being super authentic. So my question, starting with Jill, but anyone else can answer too. So how did you learn to build trust? How did you learn to build trust, so without evidence or investigation or second-guessing yourself, in yourself in an industry that's so focused on people's reactions and how you're received by an audience?
It's a fabulous question, because essentially it is, how do you stop being obsessed with how other people see you and judge you? And that is hard, especially, you know, in a profession, you know, in the media profession, you are constantly confronting, I mean, every word you utter is picked apart. And you just, you know, learn over time. And I think, unfortunately, it does take time to sort of trust your gut. And, you know, I learned to trust my gut and to certainly accept the fact that my gut wasn't perfectly attuned. Every judgment I made wasn't the right one. And I have, of course, made my share of mistakes. But, like, confronting situations where there truly are high stakes and where you maybe have to balance the importance of a story versus a possible danger to reporters of getting that story or harm to actually the sources of those stories, that somehow if you sort of do that enough and are guided by basic principles, I mean, it sounds corny, but so much of my career was fueled by, you know, my gratitude to the founders of this country for their passionate belief in freedom of the press and the important role that newspapers and other and magazines play in keeping the public informed and holding powerful institutions accountable, that it was just like the toll of time and being able to navigate and stay true to that mission that, you know, enabled me to feel that I could trust myself, I could trust my gut to make fraught decisions that, you know, again, I want to emphasize, did not always turn out great, but for the most part, I think, kept the Times on its true path.
Thank you so much for sharing that.
And follow up on Jessica or Darla, you both had a lot of courageous conviction on your past. Like, how did you learn to trust yourselves and listen to that inner voice?
I think I've touched on it before, but just putting your ear to your heart, I think, is a great way of saying it. I think you get traction, too. You get confidence in the more you listen to yourself, the more you start getting more and more confidence in that voice and what that is. I will say, I feel like we live more and more, I'll tell you what I struggle with, we live more and more in a tabloid-ish world where everybody's just so quick to judge on the internet and social media, and I feel that, I don't know, anytime I see criticism of any number of people, but especially women, I just don't jump on that bandwagon. I just want nothing to do with that hyper-judgmental, limited, fractured, one-liner kind of criticism, because I feel like that, especially as women, can really start to tear us apart inside. And so I think it's getting harder and harder a little bit if you're on social media and listening to a lot of feedback to get back into your center and trust yourself. So I keep calling it an enormous character building opportunity. I'd say thank you. And because, you know, these are the places where the more you're uncomfortable in my life, like I would see, you guys have heard the thought part of my life and all of our lives. All of those things that happened, I wouldn't be sitting here today. Yeah. If all of that adversity hadn't happened to me and I had overcome it in the ways that I did, I wouldn't be sitting here. So thusly, when challenges keep coming or I didn't make the right call, I go, okay, this is an opportunity. And I really do approach it that way and welcome the learning aspect of it.
That's great. Thank you. One of the most helpful questions I've learned is to ask myself in those hard moments, what is the gift or opportunity in this?
Yeah.
And at first, when I'm really in it, I'm like, there isn't one. I can't answer it when I'm in resistance. And then I go on a run and come back and ask it again. But anyway, that's a really powerful question. So thank you. Okay, we have time for one more question. So we'd love to hear from you.
So it seems like all of you really grew up in an environment that fostered that confidence in you. There are many of us who grow up without that confidence, enter adulthood, lacking confidence, growing even older, and still looking for it. So what advice do you have, I'm sure, for many people who are in the room, that are still trying to find that hook for the confidence that perhaps, or not perhaps, that we just did not grow up with because of our particular circumstances? Thank you.
Great question.
Well, first of all, you have to embrace the fact that you are not a victim of your circumstances, and that you have to choose to be confident and cultivate confidence within yourself, and you are very empowered and capable of doing that. I think when people are not confident, they are coming from a place of fear, and that fear is, what will this person think, or what will happen if this doesn't work out? And oftentimes their primary thought is ruled by, how do I live up to this measure and impress this person? And you've just got to start by wanting to instead impress yourself and live up to who you want to be, and recognize that what you should be afraid of is not living your own authentic life, and rather whittling it all away, being too afraid of what the other person thinks, because the reality is the little bubble in their head, over their head, isn't about you anyway. Nobody else really cares all that much. So you might as well just go out there and start living for yourself.
Yeah.
Okay, I think that was a wonderful one to end on. So I want to thank our wonderful panelists for being here today. Go big or go home.
We so far. She picks up on sports.
And, oh, God.
Oh, one quick note.
Yeah.
Jill will be joining us in Exhibit Hall A for a meet and greet right now if you're interested in chatting further with Jill. Otherwise, thank you for the inspiration, ladies.